Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Paul Venable. And Paul, we were covering the electors in Article 1, Section 2.
Right.
And so we're going to cover the electors a few times in the Constitution, obviously. And so this sets the stage as what are the parameters for somebody to be an elector.
Right.
And so we'll get to those other points, and hopefully by the time we get to the 12th Amendment, we'll actually be able to kind of lay out what an elector is and what they're supposed to do. In other words, the constitutional process of what has to happen in the choosing of the president.
Okay.
That way, there's no question, so that everybody that listens to this show, by the time we hit the 2024 election, actually, the way we've been doing this over the past century, has not been following the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's just another way that the federal government has along with the party, has been able to pervert the Constitution, the processes within the Constitution. But again, this is Constitution month or season.
Right.
Because it takes more than just a day or a week to get through this. But it's important that we cover it in context to how the Constitution is being violated. Now, one of the things that I don't know if I really covered, but I've got to go back because this one clause is highlighted as seriously violated. And the clause in Section 2 is, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So why is that highlighted? Do you know?
Well, so I read this several times, and it's, even though I've seen this before, the wording is kind of strange. You know, qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature.
Uh-huh.
And I want you to know that even though I've come to understand the Constitution, this one doesn't seem to be very clear.
Okay, so that's because people don't know. Well, actually, you should know who chooses the electors today.
Today?
Yeah. And how are they chosen?
I can tell you what we do in Missouri. The party chooses the electors.
The party chooses the electors.
Right.
And does the party actually set prerequisites?
We can.
Does the party, because I've actually witnessed in Washington State where a young black man that was a part of the party, it was a honorary position that they chose him as an elector, and he was only 19 years of age.
Okay.
Now, does that meet the qualifications requisite for the most numerous House of Congress?
It doesn't. So, it doesn't meet the qualifications of someone who would be elected to Congress.
If
you are running as a congressman, I think you've got to be 25.
Yeah, so this is what I'll read it again. The electors in each state shall have the qualification requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So here's the interesting thing. When the Constitution refers to electors, what are they talking about?
They're talking about the representatives who will vote for president.
Well, yes, but they also say, because they actually use it twice here, the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch. So in other words, the electors are our representatives, our direct representatives. And I can tell you, if you read the South Dakota Constitution, there's probably many other constitutions, they refer to the electors as the people. When the people are the electorate, they're not the electors. The electorate is the people who vote. And why do they call our representatives electors? It's all about suffrage. They actually vote for us.
Right.
So they're chosen by us to represent us in voting on our behalf on all things delegated to them.
So that's so now you have electors referencing two different things in this clause, but they are people who are chosen by the electorate to either serve us in the most numerous branches of state legislature or as people who will as electors who will vote for the president.
Right. So so technically
they must have understood this in both ways
they're representatives of the people to vote for us, to represent our suffrage in the choosing of the president or in the choosing of making laws necessary and proper for the execution of the Constitution, blah, 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 blah. So, in other words, they are representatives, but they use the term electors. Because they're going to go off and we're going to select them. And they are going to choose the president. They are going to choose the laws or decide whether we go to war or not. But clearly they reference the representatives here as electors. And the most important part that is being actually stepped on is we have electors in each state. There's a good likelihood that in 9 times out of 10 in some of the old states, like I know Wyoming, it's usually an honorary position for, people that have been around who have served the state, and the party and so forth, because they only have three, and they're always, honorary positions. And I know a few people that have been, selected as that. I don't think that they ever push the envelope in going below 25, but it's not uncommon. It is not uncommon that people don't even think about the prerequisites, that there are hard constitutional prerequisites for the Electoral College. And is this a really big thing?
I would say yes, it's a really big thing.
Because it's in the Constitution. And there's reasons for that. But regardless, you can't just ignore something that's in the Constitution. Many times we hear our government say, we do this because it's in the Constitution for us to do. But there's so many things like this that the party. So here's something that has been absconded and actually, co-opted by the parties. And the parties are doing this to, kind of show their favor and grace towards, it's this token that they throw out because, this young woman or young man of, whether it's a different demographic, what have you, this is a hallmark. We want to make this great gesture. Well, you can't make that great gesture. You got to wait till that person's 25 years old. And there's also other prerequisites, because if there's a requirement for that person to be in the state or whatever that is for a representative, I think they have to be a resident for at least a year. So anyway, and most states actually have, some of those qualifications. I honestly would like to see a longer residency for people to run for office. Because we've seen shysters like Hillary Clinton move from Arkansas up to New York and then instantly represent New York in the Senate. I just have a problem with that. But anyway.
Well, that's allowed. You know, a couple of days ago, I talked to you about how Alan Keyes moved to Chicago to run against Barack Obama for the Senate.
Yep, and he actually didn't even live there. And to me, I think that that was done because Alan Keyes was, you know, he recognized probably the threat of allowing such a progressive like that and said, well, if we can't get anybody to run against him, then I'll do it.
Well, that was, I remember that. That was his direction. Not direction. That was his, he took it on as a personal mission because I don't think anyone else would do it. And he was willing to do it.
Yeah, so here's the only problem, because I really like Alan Keyes. He, as a devout Christian, and some may think he is a, what's a good word for it? Militant Christian. he actually ran for office in a state that has really turned godless. In other words, you know, when you get to that point where the majority of the people in the state are not, you know, Christian and don't, you know, appreciate Christianity and its importance and blah, 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 they're more of the middle of the road. Well, you know, I'm Christian, but I'm not hardcore. I do good, but, you know, and they look at somebody that's a hardcore as bad. As you know, somebody that doesn't represent them, if that makes sense. But anyway.
Yeah, I want to reference that for just a moment.
Sure.
Because Illinois is a perfect example of the tyranny of the majority. Because I've got open a 2020 election map.
Uh-huh.
And Illinois looks like, I'm guessing if it has 100 counties, it looks like maybe 14 of them were blue. Okay?
Yep.
I'm making the estimation here. So I'm just giving you an example of what it looks like. We may think that Illinois is a blue state.
Sure.
Well, the democracy is at work in Illinois. That's what's happening.
Yeah, and this is how one can actually see the merit in breaking Chicago or that one corner, that little quadrant. And I don't want to say quadrant as in an equal quadrant. Whatever is necessary to isolate, you know, that blight, that illness in government. Court it off and basically make a whole new state and let Chicago be the state of Chicago and let Illinois be the state of Illinois. By, you know, by creating two separate states, by dividing it that way.
And you will, I bet we could get the people in the red counties to buy off on that.
Yeah, so the problem is that because the legislation is done. So here's the thing, and this is why counties really matter most. Because the counties are the parties to the compact. You should be able to get the parties to actually, and constitutionally and legally, the parties to the compact can say, this is so far out of whack that we want to actually have a constitutional convention and redo our constitution. If they did that, if all of those red counties did that, then it would put the fear of God in the progressives because they would realize that they would lose all of their control. And the red counties could literally hammer down really tight constraints so that they couldn't do anything anymore and take back their representation. So
well,
that
the other thing they would lose is they would lose the support, the financial support of the people they're robbing.
Yes. The rest of the state.
Right.
Right. Right. So okay. Anyways, so that stands as a solution for every state that has a large population center. Oregon, Washington, Indiana, Ohio. Ohio could be split four ways with Cleveland and Cincinnati and then the rest of Ohio. And that's the same thing with Pennsylvania, with Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and the rest of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And so anyway, let's move on to this next section, or this next portion of section two. And so the next portion of section two is highlighted in yellow. And okay. It actually was modified by the 16th Amendment.
That's this. Yes.
Yes. Correct. Okay. But okay. Notice what was modified. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of a term of years, in other words, indentured servants, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. And so that's referring to the slaves. So in other words, there's an apportionment based on those people, and these are the people that are actually going to have representation. So in other words, all people that are there, and then adding, so the free people, and then those people who are indentured servants, not Indians, or Indians not taxed. So in other words, so it's interesting how they put the exclusion in the center of that. It should have probably stated, or it would have made more sense, I guess, the way we would frame a sentence. And I'm not really one to, you know, anybody that's read my writing, because, you know, I don't get structures, you know, right all the time. But I would understand that if you put those who would be included and then the exempt at the end. So, in other words, those who are included in representation are those free persons, those bound to indentured service, and 3/5 of all other persons, and excluding Indians not taxed. Does that make sense?
It does in the way you and I would speak.
Yes.
But I've got another interpretation of why that's done that way. They are listing in probably what they considered a hierarchy.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
Okay. I see what you're saying.
Right.
Right. Yeah, so, that's a unique perspective that obviously, you know, I guess it is more of a filter in the eyes. I'm just looking at the actual structure of who would be included and then who would not be included.
Right. And I understand. And in typical English, you know, that would make sense. But from the filter that I come from, it just stands out to me.
Right. Okay. And that completely makes sense. And thank you. So here's the problem. The 16th Amendment changed this one thing right there. And so what we need to do, if you don't mind, if you would indulge me, is we need to actually go down to the 16th Amendment. And so what does the 16th Amendment say?
All right, let me scurry down there.
Okay.
Bill of Rights. No, here we go. Amendment 16. There we go.
Okay. So, and folks, the reason I'm doing this is because right now we've hit a part of the Constitution that was amended, and we need to really put it into context while we're dealing with it. This is one of the few amendments that actually changes the body of the Constitution. And so this is what it says now instead of that. So it says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So in other words, they had the ability to tax income, and the intent was to include corporations and companies.
Okay.
And so, and the reason why the intent was to do that was because they needed to make a way to legitimize corporations as a personal entity. So by creating this taxation that they tax individuals and the income of an individual and the income of an individual business, they actually created this, I don't know if you want to call it homogenizing, but they tried to create this. They're all, it's all equal. It's all of the same thing when it's really not. And so down the road, they had to wait for a lawsuit or a case to move forward for the Supreme Court to actually weigh in and actually create law that a corporation is the same as a person.
Well, I know what that case is. And I didn't put two and two together, and I don't remember the name of the case, but here's what happened. The railroads wanted to be seen as a corporate person, and there was a court case that won the Supreme Court, and it failed. However, the case notes shared something different, and it was acted upon as if it were, as if it had passed.
Right.
And then there was another case. And so what happens is I never put the 16th Amendment together with that. But up until that point, corporations were not considered legal persons.
Right. And so the reason why they wanted to get there was because they wanted to empower corporations to be able to do their dirty deeds.
Well, they've certainly done that.
Yes. Right, because that's, you know, when we look at the states, and folks, I'm really going to dive into this on Friday, because we had a conversation with the ACLJ yesterday, and I'm going to dive into this because when we really look at the new paradigm, there is, it seems like regardless of the conservative and or what have you, there is nobody that wants to actually start challenging the unconstitutionality of many of these things because it serves the purposes of the court. So I'll dive into that, but let me get back to this 16th Amendment and going back to this. So right here, they're basically saying that they have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment. So in other words, without regard to census or apportionment by enumeration. So what that means is they can come in and they can tax any and all. So in other words, a state, and I'll give you a good case in point, can you be taxed twice? Yes, absolutely. You can be taxed as a person as well as a business. And let's say your business makes so much money and you make money off of that business, it's double taxing you. So the federal...
Well,
go ahead.
You're also being double taxed because businesses, in a sense, don't really pay taxes. They pass it on to their consumers.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So what happens is you still wind up paying the business tax on top of the tax you're paying yourself.
Right. Right. But let me get into why this is important, because there is this little clause that the idiot that wrote the 16th Amendment didn't realize. And so this is how the 16th Amendment violates this one clause, or I should say the application of how they're using the 16th Amendment is a direct violation of this clause. And this is in Article 1, Section 8, and this is in the preamble. But all duties, imposts, and excises, in other words, all taxes, a duty is a direct tax, which is your income tax. So all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So in other words, if you're going to tax people, personal income, I can see that they separate people and business. If you're going to tax a person, then you have to have an equal tax that you put on this person as you put on that person. They must be uniform. And it's the same thing with business. In other words, the fact that they've created loopholes or, you know, write-offs and those types of things where a business can actually gain an advantage of not paying taxes or, you know, like Trump or what have you, then that actually flies in the face of the uniformity clause. And so, folks, they've been pulling the wool over our eyes, and they've basically been beating us with a bat, and we've gone into a break here. So So hold on to your tongue, Paul. I know you've got a few things you want to add to that. So we'll get back into Article 1, Section 2. But I just wanted to expose the reality of what we just read and how that was being violated in two ways. But anyway, we will be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so, Paul, I got you back here, right? You're back? Or are you still on? Okay, so any comments regarding this Article 1, Section 2.
Well, you preempted my comments because I agree with you. I wanted to address this, but it's good that you did as well. Article 1, Section 2. I was thinking about Article 1, Section 8 about the uniform tax.
Oh, okay, but they're all in there, so they're all linked. Because, see, when they created the amendment that actually said, okay, we're going to be, instead of basically taxing the states based on apportionment and census, we're now going to tax the states by income. And they thought, oh, you know, and this is our back door into using a progressive tax. Because what was the very first thing? They didn't tell anybody that they were, actually, so Wilson said, we're going to amend the Constitution. Folks, just so you know, anytime a president or anybody in politics says we're going to amend the Constitution for a short amount of time so we can do this legitimately, don't believe them. Because unless it is in the language that this amendment will expire in 30 days or 100 days or a year or what have you, it needs to be explicit. Because he basically lied to America and said, we just need to do this for a short period of time so that we can buy our way into prosperity. And look at, we're over a century into this fiasco. But right. If you read, go look at the implementation of the income tax. The very first year, the second year, and the third year, they instantly deployed a progressive tax. In other words, they wanted to tax people with more money, more. And they wanted to tax, you know, some people that, you know, okay, you didn't get taxed at all. And what that did was that created this paradigm that, oh, you know, us, the minion, are, you know, receiving favor from government. It's right. Government should never be able to pit one class or one group against another. That's called manipulation.
Sure. It reminds me of a term that Al Gore used when he was running for president called targeted tax cuts.
Yes.
In other words, we're going to give you a tax cut for behaving the way we want you to.
Right.
Right. And
right.
So something else occurred to me during the break, GR, and I don't know if it's relevant. Let me run this by you. All of the effort and the steam that the Article 5 convention people are pushing for, do you realize how quickly they could repeal the 16th Amendment? I think that would be something that would be popular, but it's just something that just
I know a lot of people, and you know a few people that are just fixated on the 16th Amendment,
right?
Our taxes, period. Mm-hmm. So, as a matter of fact, the majority of America is fixated on taxation,
right?
And folks, if you believe taxation is theft, then what that means is you believe that the government can tax you for anything that they want to. And that's the wrong paradigm. Taxation is not the problem. The spending of money is the problem. They need to have the power to tax. And right. If we got the 16th Amendment to be actually followed in accordance with the Constitution, it's not a problem. And as a matter of fact, even with its wrong interpretation and application of a progressive tax, it's still not a problem, because the real problem lies in the spending.
And the spending gets us into one other issue, and that is that Congress has unconstitutionally delegated its authority to regulate the value of money. Okay, so this all ties together.
Yes, it does.
I know that we're going to get there.
Yeah, okay. It does. But the fact of the matter is that the 16th Amendment is really not the big evil monster that everybody makes it out to be. It is the behavior of government that is the evil monster. It's not taxation. And so I see what you're taking from me, and ow, that hurts. And so what happens is people actually, focus on the wrong thing. And as long as you're chasing and trying to stop taxes, you'll never win. As long as you're chasing and trying to stop the symptoms of bad government, you'll never win. The reality is they don't have the authority to do what they're doing, and that's how we stop them. We have to call them out to say, okay, you can tax us. Yeah, absolutely, that's fine. But you can only tax us on what's legitimate. And, oh, by the way, all of this debt is illegitimate. We're going to audit this, and we're going to find out how much you've been spending outside of the framework of the Constitution. And there's no doubt in my mind, folks, they've always been spending more than what they bring in, always. And what they spend their money on, over 80%, 90% of it is on unconstitutional things, whether it be healthcare, welfare, the child protective services, all of these different things that, the environment, forestry. I could go on and on and on and on and on. And so the fact of the matter is that, the only way we're going to actually solve the problem, quit getting fixated on the little pain in your wallet right now. You want that problem to go away? We have to get government to behave properly. Because, it's kind of like these initiatives that they've got an initiative in Wyoming to go after to reduce their property tax. I'm going, why are you doing that? Get the state of Wyoming to stop spending money it has no authority to spend. As a matter of fact, the state of Missouri is doing the same thing, because we just covered this yesterday, looking at the state's constitution and the amendment. See, folks, people look at an amendment in your constitution as a legitimate thing. But what if your amendment is actually pointing to an illegitimate federal program and federal laws to say we're going to satisfy these federal laws that are all illegitimate? Does that make that amendment in your Constitution more legitimate? No. Does that amendment make the federal government's illegitimate, works and laws and so forth, legitimate? No, they can't make either legitimate. And so your state in Missouri is spending money on healthcare issues that they don't have the constitutional authority to do. Even though they got the people to buy into it, it's all feeding the beast. So we have to, this is why Republic Review, and the only way we get there is we have to take the counties back. So there is an end to all of this, but you have to take your county back. And I can't emphasize that enough. So let's move on, because the next one is the actual enumeration. This is still a part of Section 2. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as shall by law direct. This next one is egregiously violated. This one clause or this one sentence or part of the sentence. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made. And then they go through the different states, the 13 states, that, you know, if they join the union, then this is what they will have. And so Rhode Island, or Rogue Island, got one, Connecticut five, and so forth. And so they basically broke down the initial apportionment, and then they would reassess in the following year, because 1789, they were going to have a census in 1790, and I think it took about a year to quantify what it was, and then they did a reapportionment, I think, in 1790, at the end of 1790, 1791. So anyway, but the thing we can't gloss over, the number of representatives shall not exceed one representative for every 30,000 persons. How many people are being represented by one representative today? And that's almost a million. It's working on its way up to a million.
Right. Right now, I think it's about 755,000.
I thought it was like 780, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. Folks, can you honestly be represented? Can you actually believe that that one person in the House of Representatives is actually able to, you know, identify you and represent you and know how they're affecting you in a grand scheme? I mean, Washington had a real problem with 40,000 people. The Constitution originally had 40,000, and before they went to sign this, the one thing that Washington actually spoke up on was, he says, I don't like this. I don't think that the people can be adequately represented if it's 40,000 to one. It needs to be 30,000. And then it was Madison that reluctantly, in the Bill of Rights, included an amendment to allow it to slide to 50,000.
Correct.
And cap it there. But folks, the fact of the matter is the only way this number can change is through an amendment, which is why Madison did what he did. And so I can't emphasize enough how egregious, I mean, in a representative government, how is it that we're actually represented? So the last two sentences to Section 2 is, when vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. In other words, basically creating an indictment against the president or vice president.
Go ahead. I want to share something with you about this. A couple of years ago, right after the 2020 election, there was an idea going around about this particular clause. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers. And I had people telling me, you know what? The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker, but it doesn't say it has to be a member. Well, yes, it does. But what was going on is people were saying that the House could choose Trump and then he'd be the Speaker of the House. Had you ever heard anything like that?
Yes, I have. And that's that's all of this, you know, wild, I'll just say, deviations from the intent of the Congress. So what that means is that the Speaker, if the Speaker of the House, who serves as a representative, when they become a speaker, then what would have to change is that they would have to actually change that representative, and which would, you know, once, like, Nancy Pelosi becomes the speaker, then she is no longer a representative filling a seat, then okay. But that's not what the Constitution allows. The only people that are allowed in that chamber are representatives, and the officers thereof shall be duly elected as representatives, and they shall fill the roles and responsibilities as committee chair, as Speaker of the House, and so forth and so on. What they've done is they've created so many different positions that they say, you know what, we can choose anybody. But it doesn't say that. The House of Representatives, the whole body, out of that body shall choose their speaker and other officers. Go show me in the ratification debates that it was open to anybody other than those officers. You have to have something there that says that they could do that, or you can't. You'd have to redefine that via an amendment. Because historically, they set the precedence of who they chose. In other words, they could have easily chosen somebody like John Hancock to be the Speaker of the House who wasn't elected. Sure. They didn't. What they did was they fell within the parameters that they believed the Constitution was defined as. You know, when we talk about precedents, case law and precedents in a court, it has no impact. A judge and a jurist cannot redefine anything. But the men that created the first go-around that established this is the process, well, then voila, now we actually have an established process. And that's it. We're stuck to that. It's the same thing when you look at the, because here's an interesting thing. The Senate really had no processes defined. I don't know if you knew this or not, but John Adams really just wanted to be a speakerhead, and he just wanted to be the president. He did not have the administrative mind of creating how the journals and how the processes would work in the Senate. You know who actually created most all of the processes for the Senate?
I think it was Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, it was. So why did they have to wait 4 years? And it just speaks to the lack, you know, what the person sitting in that position just didn't have the breadth, the depth to understand what would be best to do. And so it was kind of like chaotic in the Senate. They didn't have defined processes, you know, of this concept of, what do you call it, filibuster, or these other things, because filibuster came along because Jefferson established that, you know, you had to have this very specific quorum. You had to, you know, get to this certain level to actually pass a law, to pass an executive position and so forth. And so all of those types of rules that were set in the Senate, that came from Thomas Jefferson. But they set precedents in doing that. So, in other words, they realized that to change that, they needed to actually create that the law, because it allows them. And as a matter of fact, when we read the Constitution here, they do allow themselves to set their own procedures. But to change personnel from an elected person to opening up the seat so that the Speaker of the House could be George Soros. I'm sorry, we have to have an amendment to do that. And the states should step in immediately if those types of fiascos occur. The problem is that the states are sleeping at the wheel here. But anyway, so now we're going into Section 3, which gets into the details of the Senate. And okay. I'll let you go ahead and read this. Go ahead.
Sure. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof, and this is modified by the 17th Amendment, for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote. Immediately after they shall be assembled in consequences of the first election, they shall be divided as equally as may be into 3 classes. The seats of the senators of the first class, shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year, of the second class at the expiration of the fourth year, and the third class at the expiration of the sixth year, so that 1/3 may be chosen every second year. And if vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise during the recess of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the next meeting of the legislature, which shall then fill such vacancies.
Okay, so as you saw, the italicized wording is what changed in the 17th Amendment. And so up top, chosen by the state legislature, so if you just highlight that, you know, just the words, not highlight it with a color, but, you know, just make those words in red. And then you highlight the other words below in the next paragraph in red, and you just isolate those words. What does this tell you about the Senate? It just tells you that the 17th Amendment had shifted from the people, through a democratic process, will elect their senators instead of the state legislature. Anywhere Correct. Here, because having gone through the ratification debates, it was very clear that the state legislature had suffrage in that Senate. Right?
Correct.
And actually, in Article 5, we'll get to this. But in Article 5, that suffrage is protected. And so what happened is by changing this term of he who pays the piper calls the tune, well, the Senate actually turned its back on the state legislature. So in other words, the 17th Amendment may have only changed the process of how they're chosen, but it did not change their responsibility and who they were voting for. Does that make sense?
It makes sense because the state cannot be denied its suffrage.
Suffrage, correct.
And the 17th Amendment did not address that.
Correct. And so, therefore, so this goes down, and I've reached out to Kate Daly in Utah, who has a radio show out of Utah. She's probably the biggest star that I know out of that area because she's national. And she's the only one I think that's kind of semi-syndicated out of Utah. But I tried to reach out to her. And folks, if you listen to Kate Daly, poke her in the eye and say, look, we have a real opportunity to actually force the rescinding of the 17th Amendment. Because let me ask, go to any state legislature. I don't care if it's a blue state. If you go into if somebody that is in that legislature, ask them, how responsive are your U.S. senators to the state legislature? And they will all tell you they're not responding at all. They don't listen to us. They don't do any of our bidding. Our suffrage has been lost.
Correct.
And even though the 17th Amendment allows for, and so I need, I told you that I needed to edit that document.
Okay.
Right? But because that document does not reflect this one thing, because clearly the ratification debates, and I have to go back through there and insert those comments regarding the state suffrage, regarding the importance of what the senators are supposed to do. And so what I need to do is basically prove or point out and highlight these ratification debate comments and say, look, you know, the 17th Amendment, there's no language within that amendment that changes the responsibility of voting for the state legislature in giving them their suffrage. Just because they're chosen by a different, you know, entity, by the people instead of the state legislature, you have to actually amend to redefine what their role and responsibility is in accordance with the ratification debates, because the ratification debates are legally binding. Therefore, because they're supposed to actually be representing, every state legislature in the union can come forward and say, we have lost our suffrage without our consent. Mm-hmm. Because the 17th Amendment did not take away that suffrage.
Right.
But what has happened is the Senate, knowing that they, you know, their job doesn't hinge on those folks, now they're actually being fed by the globalists billions of dollars to get these seats.
Right.
And so they're doing the bidding for those people when actually they should be held accountable. And they should actually be removed by the state legislature to say, you're not doing our representation.
Correct.
Right. And so this is how I think that Utah can actually say, you know, because of this, you know, we're not even allowing this anymore. We didn't even buy into the 17th Amendment, and now we're taking our suffrage back. And all of the other seven states, or six states, a total of seven, and then it will allow, because you already know that because of Delaware, every state can rescind their position or change their position on the 17th. And there's no doubt in my mind the 17th Amendment would go away. It would just go away. We don't have to repeal it because, like I said, the progressive era, the people that created these amendments were idiots. They did not understand the Constitution because at that point in time, constitutional literacy had really already started devolving and people just didn't, they hadn't even read the ratification debates.
Correct.
Right. So anyway, I could rant on and on and on and on, but next part is also highlighted.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So let's see. No person.
Go ahead, read it.
All right. No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States and shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state for which he shall be chosen.
Okay. So how is this not being followed?
Well, let's see. There's a note here.
Yeah, that note has everything to do with it.
Party qualifications via primaries is not listed. That's what the note says.
There you go. So in other words...
What do you mean by that?
So no person shall be a senator who shall not be detained and been 9 years. In other words, what happens is that they down-select in the selection because now it is going to the election of the people, right? And so the election of the people, and this is actually applicable to the House of Representatives. So when a person is running, you know, how is it that they can lose their opportunity because the party actually deselects them in their own election? Now, see, this is a state-ran, primaries are a state-ran function.
Correct.
And so where is it that the states can actually down-select, you know, to basically clean out to give you only one Republican and so forth and so on. In other words, how is it that they can disenfranchise that person who chooses to run for senator? How can they disenfranchise that person? Because the party wants to disqualify you by voting.
So in other words, what we're saying is, if this person meets the qualifications to run for Senate, let's let the people choose. Why does a private organization get to limit the choices of the people? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but so here's the kicker. The state does this for the party.
Oh, yeah.
And the state can't. It's one thing if the party has their own primary. But right now, because the states are paying for it, they're doing the bidding for the party to down-select the senators, which means that they're violating the rights of those people who choose to be senators. The states should have no play or no involvement whatsoever in a primary. The primaries must be paid by the party.
Well, sure.
Okay. That's the whole point here. It's, in other words, if the party is going to have control over who, because some states it doesn't matter, and we just ran out of time. So I appreciate your involvement. We'll have you back tomorrow, Paul. But, and so we'll actually bring this back up. We want to close on this because I can't emphasize enough, folks, that we've been duped by the party to allow them to actually, you know, come out to the outcomes that they want instead of what is best. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.